Call to order the Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee. And I'm going to start with some work sessions. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2180. And Janet, can you refresh our memory, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2180 is the elevator bill. It eliminates the new types, the Dash 1 amendments that you discussed at the previous meeting. Allow the frequency standards and fees for elevator inspections to be determined by administrative rule. The amendments also separate the elevator permit process and fees from the inspection schedule. There is an emergency clause added to allow the agency to adopt administrative rules before the operative date of January 1st, 2006. Mr. Chair, the reason we held this over an extra meeting was to discuss the Ways and Means referral. And the Speaker's office would like to keep the Ways and Means referral on, so that was the purpose of holding it over. Mark Long is here. If you have any questions, there was no testimony in opposition to this bill, and it has gone through the work group process with Representative Holby.
Thank you, Janet. Mark, any comments?
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Briefly, Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes. No comments. I think staff did an excellent job of communicating. And this bill is part of the governor's recommended budget. There is no fiscal impact on it, and we hope that you can move it out today.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. Representative Holby.
I really don't have many comments on this. This was a fairly straightforward bill without a lot of controversy in it.
Thank you, Representative. Chair to entertain a motion. Representative Shields.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2180 to the floor.
Dash 1 amendments.
The Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2180.
Representative Shields moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2180. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they're adopted. Representative Shields.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2180 to the floor with the due pass.
To the Committee on Ways
and Means with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Shields moves House Bill 2180 as amended.
Glad you're here.
To the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Representative
Gilman.
Aye.
Representative
Colby. Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Chalker.
Aye.
Representative
Shields.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Okay. We'll open a public hearing, our work session on House Bill 2181. And Janet, once again, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you may want to have Mark Long.
This is Christmas
another
tree.
Look at this, baby.
This is another bill out of building codes, and it was requested by the Office of Regulatory Streamlining and DCBS. It also has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. It authorizes DCBS and a number of boards under DCBS to adopt rules to govern the certification of persons regulated by the agency, including continuing education requirements. Mr. Chair, we also had mostly finished the work session and hearing on this bill. The agency had additional changes and has created a copy with tabs to show you where those changes are, and I think Mark's ready to walk through those changes.
Thank you, Janet. Mark, please.
And this is the Dash 2 amendment.
The Dash 2.
Good morning again, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mark Long. You should have in front of you House Bill 2181-2. This is the Dash 2 is the work from last time when we had a discussion list. I think it was last Friday. And we have tabbed for you the pages that where we made those minor edits, and we highlighted the words that we added so that you didn't have to go all the way through the bill. This actually replaces the Dash 1s. This bill is one of our regulatory streamlining efforts to make our licensing system operate smoother. Again, this bill does not have a fiscal impact to the division. It is part of the governor's recommended budget. It was part of a work group, and Dash 2 is the result of the consensus product, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions, Mark?
This is the one that allows the electrician to
okay plan? Is that what it is?
No.
No, Mr. Chair.
3091 or something like that. No, no. Yeah.
3092 deals with plumbing plan approval that you had in last week, I believe.
No questions? Don't see any. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah.
Representing Holby, I know you headed up the work group, so any comments?
No real comments. Mr. Long pointed out that this is just a streamlining bill to make the licensing more efficient for mostly the plumbing and electrical and some boiler licenses. Makes it easier for them to identify what licenses they need and what the requirements are for those licenses. It's a good bill. I know it's really thick, but it addressed a lot of different parts of the statutes that had to be corrected. And Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2181.
Representative Holby moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2181. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they're adopted. Representative Holby.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2181 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Holby moves House Bill 2181 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative
Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Hill.
Aye.
Representative
Aye. Aye. Motion carries. Okay, we'll open a work session on House Bill 2717A. Janet, explain to me where we're at about this bill. It's been here and it's gone and it's back.
Mr. Chair, if this is familiar, it should. This is the bill that requires a postponed workers' compensation hearing to be held not later than 120 days from the original hearing date, with certain exceptions, and increases the required notice period for a hearing from 10 to 60 days, allowing waiver of that 60 day notice period. This bill has been passed out of the committee twice, and the question was whether it needed to go to the Ways and Means Committee, and it is a speaker's intent that it do go to the Ways and Means Committee, so that would have to be a Ways and Means referral added.
And we've already adopted the
adopted Dash 4 amendments, and it wouldn't hurt to do it again, but we did adopt the Dash 4 amendments.
Well, this bill.
Representative Esquivel, please.
Do we have? Okay, I guess what I'd make a recommendation.
Yeah, yes, Janet.
We adopted the Dash 4 amendments on March 30th, so those are in the bill, and we'll just make that clear for the record.
Okay, thank you. No, just all we need to do is make the motion and send it to Ways and Means.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2717 be moved to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation as amended with our March 30th amendment.
Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 2717 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, that makes it clear that request is being added. I mean, it's a recommendation that referral be added.
So. Thank you, Janet. Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative
Kitts. Aye.
Representative
Crawford. Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. Goodbye, 2717.
Goodbye. Will we see it next week, Mr. Chair? That's the question.
Mr. Chair, that was first going to be carried by Representative Esquivel, and then it was going to be carried by Representative Gilman.
Everybody's carried that.
But not very far.
Unsuccessfully.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2200. Janet, please.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2200, and you should be looking at the, by this time, the dash two amendments. This is the first time up for this bill. It was pre-session filed at the request of the governor for the Construction Contractors Board. It is a streamlining bill as well. The dash two amendments replace the original bill, so you don't need to have a copy of the original bill out. It allows the Construction Contractors Board to establish training requirements for individuals and businesses that are licensed by the board. It directs the board to take into account the availability for training statewide and to recognize appropriate training provided by the private sector. It allows the board to approve tests for construction contractors regarding business practices and laws, and except for licensed developers, requires each business licensed by the board to have at least one responsible managing individual who has a supervisory authority over construction activities and who has successfully completed training and testing. Mr. Chair, you can look at the staff measure summary or listen to the testimony of the board for additional clarification about what the bill does, and that's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Greg, are we going through all of this? Page by page.
Representative Brown, Craig Smith, Constructive Contract Board Administrator. I sure hope not.
I did.
Me too.
We had a long evening.
I can appreciate that, and we can summarize this as quickly as you want. Before you, what we do have is some written testimony that includes on pages 1 through 3 of that document our testimony. On page 4 is an executive summary that I provided most of the members of the committee that shows what the bill did, and I think I'd like to work off of that. Besides that, in case you want to get into detail, we have designed a chart that takes the bill line by line and shows where we move things, why we move things, all of that information. And then the last two attachments on here, beginning on page 35, is the dash one amendment. And then finally, on page 60, handwritten, we received the dash two amendments. We'll just go through those as rapidly as you'd like to go this morning. Briefly, the Construction Contractors Board law went into effect about 1972. It has undergone many changes throughout those years, and as that happens, sometimes things get a little bit disjointed. And what this bill does is it tries to reconnect things so it makes the law a little bit more easy to administer, easier read by others who are trying to make sense of it, and otherwise streamline the process. There are a few important cleanups here, but again, working off page 4, which is the executive summary, item 2, we have a section of the law called 701.102. We call it contractor accountability. And this is the concept they've discussed with many of you that allows the board to keep new construction businesses that have a human being associated with it that has been associated in an ownership capacity with a bad record from establishing a new business until those bad records are taken care of. This is one of the things that drives consumers and others the most in good businesses, is a corporation or LLC running the market into the ground by poor business practices and then getting a new license with the state through a new corporation or a new LLC. This does not make the owner financially liable for those debts through a court action, but what it does say is, look, we're not going to give you another license no matter what business you start until you fix the problem from the old business. We think it's very important public policy, and the way that law had been previously written was a little bit dicey. In fact, we were absolutely clear that if we did go to Court of Appeals, that we would prevail. And join with me today is Bill Boyd, and Bill has a lot of talents, and among those is legislative drafting, and as much as he's worked in that area for a while. And he worked with Chuck Taylor, who was the original drafter of that language, to try to improve that work. And I think they've done a good job on that, and would hope that you also look at it that way. Small policy changes in this, though, should be brought to your attention. The first one, I'm looking in at the middle on page 4, under very few relatively minor policy changes, takes out the mandate of 16 hours for the education required of contractors and allows the board to adopt those by rule. In fact, the board has no plans to change that. The rule is for 16 hours. This would allow the board, however, to do away with any specific dollar or hour amount, or it could increase hours as the board so chooses. And the board, as you know, is made up of six contractors and three people who are not contractors. They're very interested in making sure that contractors know how to run a business. After all, they get the complaints when people don't do it right. Item B has to do with grandfathering in and testing. This would allow the board to make it very, very clear that the grandfathering is done by rule. We have a rule today so that people who were in the business prior to year 2000, human beings that had a business entity such as a corporation or an LLC, they come today and they want to start a new business and everything's kosher with their old business, they could qualify as the RMI without taking the test. And this would allow that to proceed. There also was a small anomaly in year 2000, there was an agreement between two industries, the one being the construction industry in general and the folks that do manufactured dwelling installers. And the arrangement that was made is that those installer folks would not be required to take that same business education and testing because they have some education and testing of their own that the industry felt was sufficient. And so the desire and the deal that was made there was to exempt them from both. As we began to analyze the law, we found that the law wasn't written like that. The law was written to say that you don't have to take the education, but go ahead and you have to take the test, which is about impossible to pass unless you have the education. So that cleans up that mistake. It allows the agency some flexibility on how to define what an owner is. That's necessary because business entities change from time to time, and we need to have that. It defines construction debt to help, again, with our contractor accountability. It removes the authorization for a four-year license, but House Bill 2094 provides that authority. We believe that will go through, and we believe the governor wants agencies to have multiple-year authority, so we will likely adopt rules that will allow for multiple-year licenses. And that gets us down to the final business that has to do with certified home inspectors. And certified home inspectors is a small group of the people that we work with. They are an important group. Again, those are the guys that come out and look at your home before you buy a older home. And this would allow us to adopt a national test rather than try to develop our own test. There's some interest in doing so, and we think it's probably a good idea. Dash 2 amendments that you have before you today have the main thing that they do is they change the name of the fee that we charge for licensees. Today it's called a license fee. If you approve this, this would be changed to application fee. Seems like a change without a real difference, but it has to do with credit card payments. And we've been advised by DOS IRMD that if we want to be successful in taking credit card payments and doing things online, it's essential that when you provide or accept and make the money transfer, that you provide the product that the money is being transferred for. And failure to do that is a breach of the contract that you have with the credit card company, inasmuch as a lot of our folks pay the fee, and then they dribble in the proofs of insurance and the bonds, and in some cases there are background checks that are necessary or desirous. Before we can actually give the license, we need an ability to take that money, run the credit card, and still be in compliance with our agreement with credit card companies. So the answer to that is to change it from a license fee to an application fee.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Stockley.
Mr. Smith, does this in any way change the fee structure or rates?
No.
Thank you.
No, sir. That would conclude my remarks. I'd be happy to entertain questions.
Greg, was the industry involved in all this process and all these revisions.
Representative Brown, the industry was involved. It wasn't involved to the degree that I wish I had, to be quite frank. We've been working with industry groups since last summer on much of these changes, and we thought we had all the irons ironed out, all the wrinkles. And it's come to my attention that one of the folks that we work with has a need that we haven't fulfilled, and that has to do with the exemption for developers. And developers are an interesting group. Developers do some awfully large projects, and one of the things that the assembly authorized last biennium was that because of the unique type of work that they do, they shouldn't be required to be involved with both the contractor education and test. That came from industry. That was not something that was opposed by CCB, but I believe CCB was neutral on that. And it was our intent in this bill to echo that kind of security. In other words, we didn't want to change that policy. In talking with leaders of that organization, of those folks, they're not absolutely satisfied with the manner in which we chose to establish that security gets the job done. And so when you're ready to discuss that issue, I would ask that perhaps you could invite Mr. Gallagher up to discuss that.
He's on the list of testimony. But there isn't anyone else on the list to testify, if that's what reason.
And I can tell you that I've run this by Oregon Home Builders, Remodelers, AGC, and they have all indicated to me that they have no problem with what we're trying to do here.
Thank you. Representative Esteban.
Yeah, when you're talking about developers, you're talking about land developers, because there's two different types. There's one that brings in land subdivision, which is mostly land use, and then there's the one that brings in the property, subdivides it, makes a subdivision out of it, and then builds on it. I assume the one that builds on it has to go through the testing?
Chair Brown, Representative Escobar, that is an area that does get a little bit confusing, and the fact of the matter is by rule, what's commonly called dirt developers, people who do the lots and put in the streets and put in the utilities, do not need to have a CCB license as long as they hire all of the folks that do that kind of work. They have a license, and the reason for that are the bonds and the types of review that go over all that process. Apparently it was thought that that's redundant to have them have a license. On the other hand, you have people who develop the buildings, and whether they be homes, apartment structures, condominiums, or skyscrapers, those are, as long as they're working on property that they own, the business owns, and as long as they hire licensed contractors, those are fit a category in a CCB structure called licensed developers. Those folks are not required to take the education or the test, the theory being that those people don't ever do the work. These people are doctors, lawyers, and investors who rely upon architects and others to do the work. They're obligated to hire a licensed contractor to do the work. And again, they were successful last year in carving out an exemption from education testing.
Any other questions? Great. Bill, you have some testimony?
No, I'm just here to answer questions that suddenly fell my way.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I don't see any. They must did a great job explaining them.
Thanks, sir.
All right.
Okay.
All right, thank you. Tom Geller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing Urban Developers Coalition, and we have no objections to this bill. We're in agreement with all the rest of the groups. My only comments on the bill, and I will be asking for an amendment to the bill, has to do with the drafting. There's probably nothing wrong with the drafting, but I've been reading bills for a long time, and in the 1970s I was able to get my mind around the rule against perpetuities for 45 minutes during the bar exam, and I've actually done statistical work on repeatability and probability for the oil industry, which I was able to retain for close to 11 and a half minutes. But I can't figure this one out. I could walk you through this if you wanted, through my conundrum. But what I simply want to do is add in Section 1 the same requirement that exists right now in ORS 701-075 that says that developers are exempt from taking the education training for the tests. Those tests are really designed for a different type of activity than the developers themselves are involved in. Most of the developers I represent have people with CCB licenses who have done the education and testing if they're the big developers. Most of the small developers go right ahead and get their CCB license and go through the education. So I'm simply suggesting we add on page 2 at the end of those three sections, a section 4 that repeats what exists on page 18 of your, on page 16 of your bill right now on line 18, which is the exception that exempts from the education the licensed developer. The way that Chuck drafted this is probably very competent, but if you wanted, I would go through why I don't think it quite makes the connection between a responsible managing individual and the requirement to take the training in Section 2. Okay. I'm sure there's probably better for me to answer questions about this and
okay.
just prattle on.
All right.
Get out.
Page 2. He wants to keep it in. What? Representative Johnson?
Oh, yeah, thank you, Mr. Were we taking it out and you want to keep it in?
Well, that won't work because they're changing the whole construction. And just quite quickly, if you turn to page, this may help, I may have to walk through it. I can read it for you, I wrote it out. If you turn to page 2 on line 18, you see the section there on page 2, line 18, which says subsection 2, which is of this section, does not apply to licensed developers. Subsection 2 is on line 16, which says a licensed business must have at least one responsible manager. So that's where Chuck put in the exemption. And that's under a definition called responsible managing individual, which is not going in 005, which is the definition section, which when they redraft the statute, they'll have to put in somewhere. When they put that in, I'm not sure how they're going to make the connection to line 7 and 8 on page 1 that says the training requirements are for individuals and businesses seeking to be licensed under this chapter, and all developers are licensed under the chapter. So it's just a clarity.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schaffer.
Mr. Smith, can we just do all that?
Chair Brown and Representative Schaffer, you best.
Attaboy. Thank you.
And the bill will still accomplish what you want to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Smith, I just something popped into my mind about all this testing and training. And I know we've grandfather in, you know, people that have obviously been in the industry for a while. But I was looking through this. Is there any requirements about ongoing education and training? And are those ones that are grandfathered in also going to be subject to that?
It's a good question. Chair Brown and Representative Holvey, there is continuing education required for certified home inspectors. At some point, I hope in the future that industry will desire and accept some form of continuing education for construction contractors. Today, to answer your questions, there is none. So you pass your test, you're in, you're exempt from the test, and that's it. Whatever training you get from other places. And I think it makes some sense, and I think most folks, whether they have a real estate background or a trades background or other kind of professional background, are used to the concept that if I've got some kind of a government certificate saying I'm qualified to work, things change every few years. You ought to have some requirement to have some education. It's a controversial topic. We talk about it at the board from time to time. There are some models, I think, that have put a stain on continuing education. In other words, made it very, very difficult and costly. But there are also some models that have to be out there that are workable and would do just what I think is necessary, which is to provide a continuing degree of maturation and information for a contractor to make sure that they have what they need to run their business fairly.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I would think that that would be a good thing for industry as regulatory issues change and, you know, how they affect the industry and, you know, just making sure people stay brushed up and how to be a good contractor. I think it's really important for the industry and the public, and I'd encourage your board to keep discussing. Thank you.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen. Committee, I got a frog in my throat today. It's more than just a word or two change, and so I'm going to ask Mr. Gallagher to work with Janet and Council and come up with some -3 amendments, and we'll bring it back. Jessica?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors. We just wanted to quickly put on the record that we appreciate the work the CCB has done with us on this bill. We support the bill. We are fine with the changes that Mr. Gallagher would like to make, but we appreciate all of their work in not only on this bill, but generally in working with industry to make sure that the legislation and other activities they bring forward not only work for them, but work for us. So if you have any questions, I'm more than happy to answer, but just wanted to put our support on the record.
Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2200 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3257. Janet.
Mr. Chair. House Bill 3257 was requested by the Oregon Ports Group, and they are here to testify. The original bill would allow a past or current public port commissioner or an employee or a person with a relationship to an agricultural business to be one of the public members on the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots. The first paragraph of background describes what the Maritime Pilots Board does. The board currently consists of 9 members that are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. Statute specifies that on the board there be 3 public members, 3 members who are maritime pilot licensees, and 3 members who are typically referred to as the shippers, the shipper members that are engaged in a company that operates commercial ocean-going vessels. There's some specific things in statute that the public members may not have, and that is in the preceding 5 years, they may not have any interest in tugs, cargo, or passenger vessels, or have held a maritime pilot's license. The statute does not specify other experience that's required or precluded for the public members. So again, the original bill would add that one of the three public members could be associated with an agricultural business or be a port commissioner or an employee of a port. You have in front of you the -1 amendments that instead of allowing a person engaged in an agricultural business to be a public member of the board, it would allow such a person to be a shipper member of the board. I understand there may be some additional ideas presented today, so I'm going to leave the rest of the testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Pat Egan and Sam Ruda?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Pat Egan, representing the Port of Portland this morning, and happy to be in front of this committee. A couple of things before I start, and I'll be introducing Sam Reed, our Marine Director, here in a couple of moments. The basic idea on 3257, which Janet, as usual, described very well, is that in the rate-making process, which we see as a very important process, and I'll get into that in a minute, there are certain stakeholders who are directly represented as members of the Board of Maritime Pilots, and there are certain stakeholders who always participate, always observe, and ultimately might pay that are not directly represented, that are not directly members of the board. And so the idea that we had, along with the Oregon Ports Group, in putting this together and introducing 3257 to the committee was originally to just try to make sure that a port representative, whether it's an employee, a commissioner, or otherwise, and a shipper, beyond the shipper definition that Janet gave you, the folks that ultimately pay the shipping bills, are allowed to serve on the Board of Maritime Pilots. And so the original bill just allowed them to be members of the among the three public members. We had then had some subsequent discussions with other folks to try to refine that a little bit more and introduce the Dash 1 amendments, which you can see were just published yesterday. We've run those past a couple of the stakeholders, haven't run them past all of the stakeholders, but I think we're making headway in terms of having this discussion. The Dash 1s had put those into had put the port representative among the I want to make sure I get this right among the public members of the board, and had the shipper, which we broadened beyond an agricultural shipper to being any either producer or ag shipper that ultimately pays these rates, among the industry representatives. Sam Ruta and Steve Brown, who you'll hear from, have had discussions as recently as yesterday to flip that, and we'd be happy to work with them and with the committee to refine that. We have had a chance to talk with the Oregon Ports Group, and Ken Armstrong, I think, is fine with those amendments as we would have them introduced and produced. As I mentioned, the River Pilots have had a discussion, and I'll leave it to them to give you their portrayal of this, and we've not had an opportunity to talk with the Bar Pilots about this. Just one quick thing I'll add before I introduce Sam is, Representative Gilman has heard a great deal from me this session as chair of the House Transportation Committee, in terms of the competitive nature of not just the Port of Portland, but all Oregon ports, and that pilotage is one of the components, not the primary component, but one of the components in cost that ultimately is taken into account when, for example, container service is provided to the Port of Portland, something that's very important to us, something that's very important to Oregon shippers, the Fred Meyers, the Nikes, the ag shippers that import and export through the Port of Portland. Pilotage is, in Oregon, relatively expensive, and that's for some good reasons. There's a long transit up to the Port of Portland. But this is something that we'd like to make sure we have a direct seat at the table as the Board of Maritime Pilots considers the rate-making process. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Sam Ruta, again, our Marine Director. He's going to tell you a little bit about why we care about this rate-making process.
I think just one quick question. The Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots represents Bar Pilots and River Pilots, so there's two different.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I would add it also there are three separate pilotage grounds, and I can leave it to Steve Brown to be a better descriptor of this, but there's also a pilotage ground for the south, for the coast, particularly for the two major ports down there. So there are three separate licenses, as I understand it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Pat. My name is Sam Ruta. I'm the Marine Director at the Port of Portland. I'll make my comments quite brief. But like any governor-appointed board, any board like the Board of Maritime Pilots really is all about balance. It's a nine-member board. It's made up of three public members, three industry members made up of industry as defined by actual shipping companies, the steamship lines that are traversing up and down the Columbia River, and then three members that are made up of the pilotage groups. So it's all about balance, and our proposal here today is in some of the proposed amendments that Pat referred to, as we've discussed this further with certainly the River Pilots and Oregon's Port Group, is certainly not an attempt to disrupt that balance. As speaking on behalf of the Port of Portland, The river system is a network. We advocate safe, reliable transportation on the river. That includes both traversing the bar and also coming up to Portland. We're pretty much the last stop on the channel, Port of Portland. We're 103 miles up the river. We believe that having a port represented on the Board of Maritime Pilots is extremely important to focus on that holistic view of the network. Transportation costs, pilotage costs, is just one component, but it is an important component of the river system, but so is safety, so is network efficiencies. And while the statute does allow the port to always intervene and comment on matters that come before the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots, we do think it's more efficient to have actual port representation as a public port on one of the boards. Of course, all members, as the chair indicated, are appointed by the governor. So Port of Portland could be one candidate, but it could be St. Helens, it could be Astoria, and any of the public ports on the river. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just close here with a couple of points. One thing that we have in common with the pilots and any users of the river system is we want pilotage to be safe, we want it to be efficient, we want it to be cost effective, and I think we all share the same goal that we want them to have lots of work, and we want that work to ultimately continue and to grow. And that's really our main interest here, is to make sure that as rates are set, that that's heard by the folks who are ultimately paying the bill, not necessarily the Port of Portland, the shippers who are paying to import and export out of the Port of Portland. We want to expand service, and we think that with the jobs that are generated out of that, and the cost savings ultimately that Oregon shippers pay generated out of that, hopefully that's something that's a common interest for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you. Pat, thanks for coming. How are, in a minute or less, can you tell us how your efforts to get lots of work for these good folks, how those efforts are going up there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, and I'll turn over to Sam here in just a moment. We've been very active since that the dark days of August, as we call them around the port, last year when both K-Line and Hyundai pulled out service. Sam has been trotting the globe. Bill Wyatt has been trotting the globe, talking both on the steamship side with all of the various representatives and on the shipper side. We've initiated something called the Columbia River Container Service Committee, which has, I believe, 50, 55 members, shippers, railroads, anyone who has an interest, and it's as broad as can be, and I'd welcome any legislative participation in that as well.
I don't know if that's a good idea.
Yeah, well, I'll leave that to you to decide, Representative Schaffer.
All right, but,
we've been very active, and Sam can tell you about his air miles in pursuing that.
Thank you. Good luck to you there.
Thanks.
Representative Escobar.
Yes, I've been reading here. I'm sorry, I'm maybe not paying attention like I should because I have been reading this bill and this information. But why do you suppose they were excluded in the first place?
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, that is a very good question. I've not done the legislative research on the initial portion of the statute. I think the intent, as I read the language, and you see that in the basic part of the bill, on excluding individuals that have a financial interest, or at least giving them a five-year timeout period before they can serve on the Board of Maritime Pilots, is to try to, I guess, set up a wall between those that might have a default interest and would not be objective in setting the rates. I guess I would submit, in looking at that statute and why we introduced the bill, you have direct interests sitting on the board as it is. Certainly the pilots who are active members as they sit on the board and as they set the rates, and the steamship companies who are actively engaged in paying these rates, who are sitting on the board. What our intent is in putting this this forward is to make sure that the other stakeholders who are sitting at the witness table or providing testimony also have an opportunity to sit on the board itself as they set rates.
Wow. Representative Holy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me how do people become a member of the port in Portland? Are they elected, or what's the makeup of the port members themselves?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, that's a good question. The port itself, the Port of Portland, is a creature statute. Our commission members are appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, and that's also true of the Port of Coos Bay. All of the other ports, and I would leave it to Ken Armstrong to give you the full detail on this, but as I understand it, they're generally elected by local port at local port elections. So what we're proposing is any port commissioner, whether it's Port of Portland, Port of Coos Bay, Port of Astoria, any of those commission members and any potential port employee could be a member of the Board of Maritime Pilots. So it's not just the Port of Portland here. It would be any of the 23 ports in the state.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
I guess one of my questions would revolve around our the shippers and the pilot groups. Are they represented on the port commission? I mean, typically, are they the makeup of the port members?
Obviously, this changes as the governor appoints commissioners to the Port of Portland. Currently, today, we do have one of the commissioners, Commissioner Steve Corey from Pendleton, is a wheat farmer amongst his interests. So there's nothing that precludes being having a cargo interest or having a past life in shipping or even pilotage on serving on at the Port of Portland commission or being a Port of Portland employee for that matter.
Thank you.
Janet, you had a question?
Oh, thank you, Sheree. I just wanted to clarify or confirm that you still mean for it to be optional but not required that a shipper. Okay. And the other thing I wanted to clarify, and I may have been confusing, because the term shipper it usually means the person having cargo on the ship, and I guess I referred to the shipper member meaning the shipping company member. So the three members now are shipping company members, and the request is for a shipper member, so an agricultural or industrial person who ships, who wants their cargo shipped.
Correct. Mr. Chair and Janet, you're correct on both counts and perceptive on both counts. As far as what we're trying to get accomplished here is to take away the preclusion of a shipper, and I'll get into that in a second, or a port employee or commissioner. So yes, it would be optional. It would not be a mandatory dedicated slot to either one of those. And as far as the definition of shipper, you're right. We're sort of jumping back and forth between a steamship company, which is the three shipper slots today, and someone who I think we've got in mind, which potentially would be an agricultural producer that ships internationally, or a manufacturer, say Gunderson, that ships their product internationally. So what we're intending, and what we would be happy to try and hone down in on future amendments, would be an Oregon-based producer of something that is shipped, and so therefore a shipper internationally. I think that's the intent.
Any other question? The three at public members are at large, I assume. Can you tell me, without identifying, what their backgrounds are? What's the mix now?
Mr. Chair, the three public members are Katie Iman, Don Christensen, and Alex Duarte. Mr. Duarte is the most recent member. He is he's, I believe, chief legal counsel for Quest Communication. So he's familiar with rate setting processes at the PUC relative to telecommunications, but not here, and he's been a valuable asset. Katie's background is... I can't remember how long she's been on the board, but she's been there for some time. She's the chair, and the chair is selected from among the members. What's that? Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Christensen, who was nominated and serving, he was appointed just before Alex Duarte, who, as Pat mentioned, works chief counsel for Quest. Mr. Christensen is retired. His principal interest based on his application for serving as a public member is basically a recreational user of the river. It's been past involvement in sort of the Sea Squadron, Sea Scouts, so pretty much as a user, recreational on the river.
Okay. Okay, so there is there any representation by industries in Oregon now?
Mr. Chair, to the extent that the steamship operators are themselves representative of some industry in,
yeah,
in
the state, shippers,
yes,
yeah.
But as far as the shipper that I've described it, they have been precluded by the interpretation of the statute of someone that's got a financial interest in the rate setting from sitting on the board, okay. And that's what we're trying to undo.
Oh. Representative Office.
So that means a nice person from the grain industry could be put on this. Is that what you're talking about?
Mr. Chair.
I'm not volunteering.
You might have someone in mind.
I don't think Chair, he didn't want
Duffler, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Everybody laughs. So.
Thank you.
Could I have Dave Biscom and Steve Brown?
Chair, committee members, good morning. For the record, my name is Dave Fiscum, here representing the Columbia River Pilots. With me to my right is Captain Steve Brown, the president of the River Pilots. We're here to make a few comments on House Bill 3257 and to outline for you, before we're done, a tentative agreement that we reached yesterday in discussions with the Port of Portland concerning some amendments to the bill. There, as Janet has implied in one of the things she said, and as Mr. Regan said, there was not time in the last few hours to discuss this with all parties. We've done so in the hallway this morning, but we believe the agreement that we reached, which we'll describe for you in a few moments, is one that holds some potential to be, at least from stakeholders, a consensus solution to this bill. That time will tell on that. And we'll be happy to describe that to you, as well as talk about a process by which amendments could be drafted in this committee or on the Senate side, depending on your preference, and we'll get to that in a minute. But first, I think it would be appropriate for me to turn to Captain Brown. Steve, as you'll see in a moment, knows a lot more about piloting than I do, and so he'll make a few comments to you, and then we'll come back and be able to answer your questions in a few moments. So, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, Captain Brown.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, I am Steve Brown. I currently serve as president of the Columbia River Pilots, a group of 46 pilots who pilot ships on the Columbia River between Astoria and Portland and other ports along the way. I've been a ship pilot for over 21 years, and as I mentioned, I'm currently serving as president of our group, a position I've held for over 6 years. I also serve as a vice president of the American Pilots Association, which is a national trade association of state-licensed pilots. There are 60 groups of state-licensed pilots in this country, and they pilot over 95% of all of the deep-draft vessels that move in this country. In Oregon, there are three such groups of pilots, as was mentioned earlier. 19, I believe, is the number on the bar, the Columbia River Bar. 45 pilots in the organization I represent, the Columbia River Pilots. In our case, we pilot the 85 miles from Astoria to Portland in all kinds of conditions over one of the most difficult and narrow channels in a pilotage world. The other group being the Coos Bay-Yaquina Bay Pilots. There are two pilots in Coos Bay-Yaquina Bay currently, and they service those two ports. One of the realities in Oregon is because of the length of the transit, there are two pilot groups. The only other port in the country of a similar nature in length on a river is the Mississippi, and there are three pilotage groups there, the bar and then two river groups. And again, that's because of the length of the river transit. There's a substantial difference in training regime for the bar and the river pilots. Typically, a bar pilot gains his experience as captain of ocean-going vessels. River pilots, for the most part, learn the river by serving on the river. In my case, I worked on towboats on the Columbia Willamette River and Snake River. I started in 1967 on the towboats. In 1984, I entered the river pilots. Finally, it's important to add that pilotage in Oregon is regulated by the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots, and it is a 9-member entity. three members representing pilots, one from each of those three grounds, three members representing the industry, and then the three public members. As you can see, the board is both representative and delicately balanced. With that in mind, we've been talking with the port over the last couple of days to agree on changes in the composition of the board, but not upset its delicate balance. We think we've achieved this objective by the following. We're proposing that one of the current industry seats be reserved for a representative with connections to a port in Oregon. We'll give the ports the needed, understandable, an official role in regulating pilotage. Also proposing that one of the public members could be drawn from the agricultural community which grows and produces the crops, many of which go down the Columbia River. As I said, this would change the composition of the board, but it would retain the balance that allows the public members to play a key role in deciding pilotage issues, which we think is in the public interest.
Chair, let me make just a couple other comments, and I want to just reiterate what Steve has said. We are proposing in the last hours a couple changes, and I'll talk slow for Janet's benefit at least. We're proposing that one of the current industry seats be reserved for a port slot in the way that Mr. Egan has described and Mr. Buda have described. And we're proposing that one of the public members be drawn from the agricultural community, which grows and produces crops, which then are shipped. And again, Mr. Egan, I think, described that very well in his comments to you. Point I wanted to add is that we recognize this is a revision to House Bill 3257, which has come up in the last hours, and as such, it was not possible to get amendments drafted for your consideration today. If you plan to act on the bill today, we wanted to make these comments for the record and alert you to our intention to work with other stakeholder groups to try to propose these amendments, which we hope can be consensus amendments on the other side. If you plan to hold the bill in committee, we'll be prepared to try to work to achieve that objective before the bill moves out of this committee. So, Mr. Chair, with that, we'd be pleased to try to answer your questions.
Thank you. This is on another issue, Steve, another incident. Back in the 1980s, there was a log ship on Yaquana Bay was headed out. They just loaded up and they were headed out, and just before they got to the Yaquana Bay Bridge, they straightened out the channel and drove that thing right up into the Coast Guard station and flattened their boathouse and their dock. Was that a river pilot or a bar pilot?
Actually, in the early 80s, there was a Yaquina Bay pilot. Because there was so little work on Yaquina Bay, the Coos Bay pilots, and well, I guess the Yaquina Bay pilot retired, and the Coos Bay pilots then
right
took over
after that.
Right, probably right after that.
Mr. Chair, it must have been a bar pilot.
Yeah, wasn't there a pilot?
Mr. Gallagher is prepared to answer that question.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Where did he come from?
Any questions? I don't see. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Tom Gallagher, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Columbia Bar Pilots. I only have a couple of things to add to the testimony that's been in front of me. I think this bill is here for some very practical reasons from the port, and I'd like to offer my opinion on what they are. Right now, the board consists of three pilots who have a very special interest in the rate making, three shippers who care very directly about the rate making, and three public members. And in point of fact, it's often the three public members that make the ultimate decision. They're basically the neutrals between two parties who are adversarial in a rate case. For as long as I've been doing this, which is about 6 years now, I always thought this board was made up in the most stupid way possible. You put six people with extremely vested interest in the outcome of the rate case on the board that makes the decision. And you tell them they can't have ex parte contact with their fellow pilots or their fellow shippers, and they can only get information as they get out of the rate case. It has been subject to some discussion as to how these people can actually act as impartial public board members when they're actually directly affected by the outcome of the rate case. And that really boils down then to those three public members. The shippers and the pilots are on there to offer their expertise and their advice and their insight and to bring a background to the board itself. But it is the three public members who are clearly without an interest who make the public decision on what is the only regulated charge on the Columbia River or in the Coos Bay pilotage grounds, and Quinna Bay pilotage grounds. So this is truly a negotiation that ends up in a contested rate case, which is ultimately decided by this board. So moving the pieces around in this board are not simple checker moves. These are moves that have a real outcome in day-to-day life. If you look at the original bill on page 1, line 16, it says that the public members can't be engaged in commercial pursuits in the maritime industry. I do not read that as precluding a person who is not in not in commercial pursuit on the river, but who produces a product that's shipped on the river. I don't see why right now an agricultural person in the agricultural community couldn't be put forward, nominated by the governor, and approved by the Senate. I don't see why somebody who represents Gunderson or Snitzer, some of my other clients who were also commercial shippers on the river, producers, that because they're not directly engaged in maritime commerce. We've done in my tenure about 6 new members of the Board of Maritime Pilots, and they're very carefully balanced decisions from the governor's office to balance out this delicate relationship on the board. And the public members in the past have all been agreed on by the three parties, and the port is active in promoting or advocating for certain members. I, like the previous speakers from the river pilots, really have no objection to putting one of the port members on as a representative of management, in this case, or representative of one of the shippers. In the last rate case, or in the current rate case that we are involved in, the Columbia River Bar Pilots, our opponents are the Port of Portland and the shippers. They both have attorneys, they both intervened in the case, and they're both actively taking positions on what the rate should be. So we would simply be moving another interested party onto the board. And I have no objection to moving that interested party into the three slots reserved for interested party on the management side, nor do I have any objection, in one sense, to having public members. And we in the past have advocated for a particular public member who's a former member of the Port of Astoria. Of the board of the Port of Astoria. So, there are very competent public members out there that have some background in this, in agriculture and other things, that I'm sure we would get behind and support when they came forward. If you do put together a group to look at some amendments on this, we'd be happy to participate in that. But remember, where I'm always going to be coming from is the fact that I think this board is fundamentally flawed in the fact that you have 6 special interests on the board. I think that those public members ought to be truly public members, just like the public members are in the Port of Portland, the public members are in the Transportation Commission. They're people that represent the interests of the total state. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Representative Shaw.
This is out of my own curiosity, but it's $24,396 to come up the river. That's what Mr. Egan presented. I imagine the insurance must be incredibly high on these, the liability these workers carry. And then I have another question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, you asked a very good question that is debated a number of ways, and I'm not really qualified to answer that. There are costs to the shipper for speed coming up the river, for turnaround time. Mm-hmm. There's the length of the river and the time it takes to come up the river, which is different from most ports, which add to the cost of the pilotage. There's the expense of the transportation, the helicopters and the fast boats to get over the bar. There are the costs of environmental protection for safety on the river, and I'm sure that all the parties, the port, the river pilots, and the bar pilots, have these costs foremost in their mind. It's very clear, and you'll hear many times from the port, that it costs more in pilotage costs to move a ship from the ocean to the Port of Portland than it does almost any other pilotage ground in the United States, for certain. I will say that the Columbia River Bar pilots and the Columbia River pilots are paid less. They make less in compensation than every other pilotage group in the United States.
Well, and that's my follow-up, please. And so if I hear your concern right, that we could, if someone with a vested interest were appointed to one of these three areas that's in the middle, it could tip the scales one way or the other.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I believe that any member appointed to the board would act in the best interest of the state. I believe that each of those individuals would hold that public trust. I believe the interest groups would be suspicious, and that creates a public problem.
Yeah, it is a problem. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Kentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To touch on Representative Schaffler, what he just expanded upon, I worked at the Port of Tacoma all through high school and college, as a member of the ILWU Local 23 Longshoremen's Union. And when I saw the light and went to the right. That being said, so I understand, you know, and I've also worked up in Seattle. The time that it takes. I mean, that's what accounts for these costs. Isn't that as simple as that? I mean, these ships are coming straight in off the Pacific, going into Puget Sound and waiting out there. I mean, it's not a huge trek to get from the port of Tacoma out to the point where the requirement is that we navigate the ship in. I mean, that explains that very simply, doesn't it?
Chair Brown, Brother Kitts. I think that is one of the elements. I think it is a big element, the fact that you have the two different pilotage change off, that the trip can last over 8 hours. Another big part is there's no bar in Tacoma. There's no bar that requires the safety equipment and protection for the pilots and the ships that we have in the Columbia River. But in all fairness, there are other costs on the river, and I don't mean other, in pilotage. There are other costs on the river that we could approach in different ways, and those ideas have been proposed and batted back and forth. I think there's a great deal of sincerity among all the groups to find out if there's a way we can positively reduce those costs. We do not profit if shipping goes down on the Columbia River. I can look at the chair who used to have the port of Newport and the port of Yaquina and to some extent the port of Coos Bay. When that shipping goes away, the pilots don't have any work.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tom. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3257, and it's the chair's intention to put together a work group to see if we can resolve the issues while we move it over to the Senate side, and hopefully can do it fairly quickly and easily. Okay. Let's see. Where are we at now? Okay, open hearing on House Bill 3091. Janet, can you give us up to speed?
House Bill 3091 would authorize Oregon commercial banks, trust companies, financial holding companies, bank holding companies, and Oregon savings banks to acquire and hold stock in corporations that are licensed to transact title insurance, and would also authorize corporations that are owned by banking institutions and financial and bank holding companies, but not the financial institutions themselves, to be licensed insurance producers to transact title insurance. The changes are made to both banking statutes and to insurance statutes, and the changes in the bill are kind of hidden. They on page 2, line 40, it says except for title assurance is taken out. This is a existing statute that allows financial institution to own stock in a corporation that transacts other types of insurance, but there's a current exception for title insurance. So that's on line 40, page 2. Same change for financial holding companies on page 3, line 23. On the top of page 4 for Oregon Savings Banks. And then the changes to the insurance code are at the bottom of page 4. And again, line 37 except for title insurance, which is a current limitation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Tim Martinez and Mike Paul. Good morning.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. To my right is Mike Paul, chairman of the Oregon Bankers Association board this year. Mike will have some comments. In fact, do you have some handouts for that or just... No, okay. We'll have some comments, but I just want to begin by thanking the chair, your administrator, and the committee for your courtesies this session. This is, I think, the last OBA bill you will see before you, and we appreciate your time and interest in the legislation that we've presented this session. As the administrator once again ably explained, 3091 would allow banks to get into the bank companies to get into the title insurance business. Just a little bit of background before Mike presents his testimony. In 1987, this legislature granted Oregon banks insurance powers. The only insurance power that was not granted at that time was the ability to get into the title insurance business. Everybody on the dais and most of us in this room have been around long enough to figure out that there was somebody that didn't like that piece at that particular time, and the banks were able to trade that away for the other powers. That's not an uncommon experience. But when you, as time went by and I think insurance interests became more comfortable with banking in insurance, and in fact down the road there was legislation that allowed them to actually buy insurance agencies, there was some concern at that time that the banks were going to come in and just try to flood the insurance market. That has not happened. I don't expect that to happen. But what changed as far as title insurance was the 1998 legislation in Congress known as the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. Somewhat also known as the Financial Modernization Act. And it really tore down the barriers between financial institutions, insurance, and other types of commerce. And I would just remind the committee that in 1998 in the Congress you had the House and Senate were controlled by Republicans, but you did have a gentleman by the name of Bill Clinton as president. So it was done in a bipartisan manner. And what that law says as far as insurance is concerned is that the states are able to allow banks to get into the insurance industry if their law allows it. Well, obviously in Oregon we already had a law in place that allowed us to get everywhere except for title insurance. So that's what we're trying to do today is change Oregon law to allow us to take that one last piece of insurance business that we're not able to enter into today. In my conversations with most of you, I've talked about the fact that I expect a handful of banks at best to get involved in this. This is not something I don't think you're going to see again the mega interstate banks get involved with, Wells Fargo and others, Bank of America. And in fact, they really have that authority to do that right now as national banks, and most of them are not doing that. I see this more in the community banks and the local Oregon banks that take a look at this. And I think it'll be those that do a lot of real estate lending, and that's their niche, as opposed to business lending. So I would just assure the committee that this is, once again, not a grab by the banks to take over the insurance market. And would be happy to answer any questions. But before I conclude, let me just also say that there is consumer protections on this issue. They are at the federal level. I spoke with Mr. Simpkins, who I believe is still in the back of the room from DCBS. It would be something that if they became aware of in the course of their examination, they would forward on to the FTC and the national regulator. And by that, what I mean is if I go in to see Mr. Escoval, who's the local loan officer down there at Premier West, and he makes it very clear that in order to get this loan, I have to buy my insurance, whether it's the property and casualty or the title. That bank and Mr. Escoval is breaking the law, and that would be punishable by the FDIC and other federal regulators. So those protections are in place, and again, the state would be looking for those, as I understand it, in the course of their exams, and if they were to uncover any of that, it would be reported to the national regulator. And having been around banking now for for a few years, nothing gets them more excited than having something be reported to the regulators. But with that, I'll turn it over to Mike Paul.
Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Turn it over to the regulators. That does strike fear. Good morning, and thanks for the opportunity to be here this morning and present in front of your committee. My name is Mike Paul, for the record. I am here today on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association in my capacity as chair of the association, which has a 100th birthday this year. You'll be representing the diverse interests of both state and nationally chartered banks, trust companies, and savings and loans throughout the state of Oregon. I'm here today to support of House Bill 3091. The bill before you this morning seeks to permit banks, trust companies, financial holding companies, and savings banks the ability, the authority to acquire and hold stock and title insurance companies. In essence, allowing bank holding companies, similar to parent companies, the ability to offer title insurance products and services that fit the respective bank's business model. This is what we're looking for the future. We believe this is not only a pro-business, but a pro-consumer choice, competitive piece of legislation that will be good for community banking and customers throughout the state. Tim mentioned in particular that the national banks, and we have many of them in the represented in Oregon, have the authority to offer this service in a variety of states. This bill would allow community banks the ability to compete in the same level as nationally chartered banks. As chairman of the association, I can assure you this proposal has been fully discussed and debated by bank executives throughout the state, including our board of directors. In many instances, banks enjoy a long and successful history of client relationships with members of the title insurance industry. We value them as depositors and frankly, have very good relationships with them. Many banks are on record as having no interest whatsoever in entering the title insurance field. Other banks are focused niche service providers that, regardless of their deposit relationships with title companies, are narrowly focused on specific banking activities where title insurance would not be an appropriate fit. With all that being said, the bank and financial services landscape has dramatically changed over the past 25 years. This proposal, we believe, represents the next logical step. For example, brokerage houses have offered bank-like deposit and checking accounts for years. Now, you can go into just about any nationally recognized insurance company and emerge not only with your property casualty insurance intact, but with checking accounts and certificates of deposits. Clearly, the traditional lines that once separated the various financial service industries have become blurred. Products and services have emerged that address new opportunities or, in some cases, get around old, outdated prohibitions, such as interest-bearing sweep accounts and prohibitions on paying interest on corporate checking accounts. Congress has addressed this shifting landscape by passing landmark financial modernization legislation that opens the door to these types of opportunities. More importantly, customers are demanding better, faster, and more competitively priced services that we must at least be able to offer. In closing, Mr. Chairman, we believe House Bill 3091 provides merely an option, merely a choice, not an expectation to financial companies who might choose to enter the title insurance business. We encourage your support and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mike. Any questions? Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this, and you know, it may be a good bill, and I talked to Mr. Martinez earlier about this, and it occurred to me, I was just concerned about how this affects the current title insurance industry, and will we be enabling a bank basically to subsidize their title insurance part of their business with profits or fees from other parts of their banking products?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Holby, the title insurance is a regulated industry. The pricing schedule is really set somewhat by statute. So we haven't really spent a lot of time talking about the pricing structure. We frankly don't have too many members that have really expressed a strong desire to enter the business. There are, as Tim mentioned, there are some, there's tying legislation that prevents a bank from requiring the use of a title company or an affiliated company for any service, for that matter. Then it's reportable. It's a reportable offense. So I don't expect it to. I wouldn't expect that there'd be any actual subsidy. We are in this business capitalists, I guess, as you call it, business people. We would only enter a line of business if we think we can generate a profitability model, or run it profitably, and maybe, in our case, an 18 to 24 month ramp-up time is about the threshold of pain. So I don't think you'd see a whole lot of subsidy toward that business.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Pauly, I don't know, Mike, if you can answer this, but mayou can talk a little bit. You, Umpqua Bank, where Mike is employed, it has a holding company, and you purchased a securities firm a few years ago. Is that something that is self-supporting as the securities firm? That's the same type of question.
Yes.
Correct.
Yes, we believe, in all honesty, that the brokerage firm is not nearly as profitable as it could be. And we say that constantly.
Any other questions? Janet, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about retaining, this is in Section 5 of the amendment to the insurance code, the retaining of the prohibition on a banking institution actually transacting title insurance.
Mr. Chairman, Administrator Atkins, yes, that's where, because what we're doing this bill is making it under the holding company, so it would not be under the bank, it's under the holding company.
Okay. The, what I don't know about a title insurance business, it's a very large book, but the would you say to characterize the and the competition in the title business is more associated with fees than, or with service than fees?
Mr. Chairman, I know Mr. Monroe is in the room, and that might be a better question for him, but my understanding is it's both. Occasionally, especially in rural parts of the state, there aren't a lot of options over there. I mean, there's one company in town, so that's hard to look at either fees or service in that case when you only have one option.
Yeah. Thank you. Any Representative Escobar?
Yes, this is a very highly regulated industry, and I'm going to give you an example of 4 years ago when you know that there's a substantial more amount of sales and transactions and title insurance in California than there is in the state of Oregon. I believe the state of Oregon at that time had a higher net profit than California. And the reason they did, even though California's business was 10 times greater than Oregon's, the reason they did is because California's unregulated. And what I mean by that is that they're virtually giving their profits in order to entice people to do business with them. The state of Oregon, the insurance people allow a title company to give something to the tune of $2.83 in value of anything that they hand out. California, I believe, unless they've changed that, they were giving in, they were giving furniture and office, you know, they were giving away the sink. Arizona, I know, sometimes they have a tendency to do the same thing. So Oregon is one of the few states that is very highly regulated by the insurance commissioner, and they're very, very well regulated. Now, the only concern I have here is steering. That is a big concern of mine. I have the same thing with realtors that own parts of mortgage companies as well. It's called steering. It's against the law, but how many people know that it's against the law, and how many people know they've actually been steered?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Escobar, you know, in the banking world, we call that anti-tying, and that's the point I didn't make very well, is there are federal rules. The regulators look for that in their exam. They have authority to write you up and impose penalties for that. As I also mentioned in talking to Mr. Simpkins from DCBS before the hearing, if they see any evidence of that in their exam, they will report that to the federal regulators. So those
protections are in place, but you're right. If I, as a consumer, don't know they're there, but there is, and I'd be happy to get you copies and share with the committee as well, there are disclosures that are made that you do not have to buy either your property and casualty insurance or your title insurance. If you choose to do so, here's our pricing structure.
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Escobar, I'd like to tag on to that a little bit. The exam process and the internal control review that our industry just went through in the past year as part of Sarbanes-Oxley, our compliance committee has been charged with the oversight of all federal regulations. So in terms of the degree of scrutiny this gets, the federal and state examiners who review our company put a lot of teeth into how we disclose and the documentation behind that and the procedures behind it. And we just finished a review, and there's a lot of scrutiny given to that. So it's a good comment you have, but I think we do have the controls in place for that.
Yes. Now, you will, if you're dealing with a bank now, and they have a monetary interest in a title company, would they not have to disclose that up front with the individual that they do have a monetary gain?
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, yes, sir.
Okay. Is there any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Can I have Jack Monroe, please?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe, here today on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association. I'm only thankful that you didn't drag me up here on one of those panels and force me to sit next to Martinez, because I do have my reputation.
like consumer protection, don't you?
I simply signed up, I guess, because I did have a couple of questions from members before the hearing. And I was thankful for the fact that a couple of members did come to me. I think, as I indicated on the sign-up sheet, we're neutral on this, and I think most of your questions have sort of gone to the consumer protection aspect of it, and I think really the answers are, that you've received have been accurate, in the sense that, one, it's not easy to get into the business, so not any bank is likely to make that decision. I mean, it requires a title plant in each county and meeting some other requirements. And as came out in the dialogue that those who preceded me had with both Representative Holvey and Representative Escobar, there are both federal, and I'm not really familiar with them, but I'm assuming that the state provisions mirror in many aspects those at the federal level. There are state statutory provisions and regulations that deal with essentially the cross-marketing of various products that a financial institution might be involved in, whether it's property and casualty and i.e. homeowners insurance or title insurance, that prohibit those financial institutions from tying the transaction, i.e. you have to buy the homeowners or the title insurance from us before you get the loan. So there are those kind of regulations that are out there to protect consumers in those instances. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? Representative Escobar.
Well, I would assume that if the bank's going to be involved in title insurance, they would have to purchase the company, because the statute today, I believe, is you have to have a 50-year plant in order to initiate a new title company, so therefore you'd have to more or less purchase somebody.
Representative Escobar, I think you're right. Although certainly somebody could put together a title plant, but you're correct. The requirement right now is and does require a 50-year back plan, if you will. So that's.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you.
Is Mr. Simpkins from DCBS? Could I ask you to come forward, please? I just does DCBS have any position on the bill, one way or the other?
Well, for the record, I'm Ed Simpkins. I'm the manager of the finance section for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities within the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and we're neutral on this issue.
Hadn't noticed. Okay. Any questions? All right. Thank you, sir. Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 3091? And then I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3091 and open a work session on House Bill 3091. Representative Kitts?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3091 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3091 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Crawford.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Esposito.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried.
Want me to carry?
Representative Esquivel volunteered to carry it. Thank you, sir. Let's see, we're down to open a public hearing on House Bill 3459. Janet?
Again. Mr. Chair, House Bill 3459. Would expand the definition of motor vehicle for purposes of the motor vehicle franchise laws in the state to include self-propelled devices that operate off-highway or on private roads. That's the original bill. You should have the Dash 1 amendments that were requested by the proposer of the original bill to narrow that inclusion. It will maintain the current definition of motor vehicle that's in the franchise statutes, but add or used in construction to add construction vehicles. And so their distributors and manufacturers and dealerships would come under the franchise laws of Oregon that now cover motor vehicle, typical traditional motor vehicle dealerships. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Tim Martinez, Daryl Fuller, and Jeff Simmons.
I thought Martinez said he wasn't going to be back.
As a banker.
As a banker.
He's a truck driver
He's
now.
A trucker now. Got it. I'm back. Nine operator. Good morning again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Halton Company out of Portland. To my right is Jeff Simonson. I apologize for my bad handwriting. My mother wanted a doctor. What could I say? Mr. Simonson is the president of the Oregon Machinery Dealers Association, and he'll have some remarks. And then Mr. Fuller graciously agreed to come to the table as well, because the bill we're talking about had its genesis back in the 2003 legislative session. Let me just briefly talk about the Halton Company. The Halton Company today or this year is celebrating 65 years. They moved to Oregon from California in 1956, which was a very good year. It was the year I was born, so I know it was a very good year. They employ 340 employees throughout the state. They are one of the largest heavy equipment dealers in the state. And what happened, or what the genesis of this bill, is prior to 2003, there was kind of a general understanding or acceptance of what did or didn't qualify under the dealer franchise statutes. In 2003, Mr. Fuller, in an effort to strengthen and clean them up, added a definition for motor vehicle. And that is in the statute and says, a self-propelled device other than a motorhome used for transportation of persons or property upon a public highway. And that was the new part, transportation of persons or property upon a public highway. Well, clearly heavy equipment doesn't fit under that definition. The change in the law was not caught until after the session.
I have been recently engaged by Halton to try to get that fixed, and that is accomplished in the Dash 1 amendments. Our bill introduced through Representative Kitt's committee a couple of weeks ago initially was going to make it overly broad in some folks' opinion. So we've offered to amend it down and get to the specific issue we're looking at, and that would be in line 18 where we add the words in construction. That's again the genesis of the bill. We see this as a not necessarily a cleanup, but just making sure that what we believe was in place prior to 2003 is put back into the statute. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions and turn it over to Mr. Simonson for his comments.
For the record, my name is Jeff Simonson, president of the Oregon Machinery Dealers Association. I believe every heavy equipment manufacturer's dealer that is in Oregon is represented by our association. I'm here on behalf of them in support of this bill. The dealers spend tens of thousands of dollars a year in training and updating their facilities and representing these manufacturers. And we just feel that to have this amendment would help protect our businesses that are, for the most part, family businesses and about a part of this community.
Thank you, Jim. Daryl, do you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller representing the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. I'm here mostly as a color commentator to answer any questions that you may have about the franchise law in general, as it's a law that was originated on behalf of auto dealers and other entities have sort of come and gone from the franchise law as the marketplace is dictated. You'll see in the definition of the motor vehicle that recreational vehicles are excluded. They used to be included, but they wanted to have their own franchise law because of some of the differences between a recreational vehicle and regular motor vehicles. Heavy trucks were in, and we're out, and then the heavy trucks back in again, and so this is sort of an undulating process, and so I would be happy to answer any questions people have about how the franchise law operates and what its purpose is.
And this is a relationship between the dealer and the manufacturer.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
I
heard last night that Monaco Coaches is leaving Oregon. Is that true? Have you heard that?
Representative Schaffer, I had not heard that. I vaguely recall seeing something that they were cutting a number of employees, but I don't remember seeing anything saying they were leaving.
500, I heard. But what I really wanted to say was I hope Mr. Simonson and his members of his association are so busy in the next few years, you ain't got enough stuff to keep us going. That's what I'd really like to see happen.
We would love to see that ourselves.
Thank you.
Representative Holdy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think what I read was Monaco Coach, just for clarity, was moving from Bin to Coburg.
Yeah.
They're consolidating.
Excuse me. Thank you for clarifying that.
They were leaving Bin, so Burley was right.
but I did have a question whether this motor vehicle definition includes self-propelled devices used in agriculture. Are they under some other franchise laws or...
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, under the definition we currently have for motor vehicles, I believe some farm equipment would probably qualify because they are licensed to drive over highways. Some of the larger devices may not be covered under that definition. But I don't specifically know which ones would or wouldn't.
Well, I'm just curious. Thank you.
Any other questions? Everybody shaking their head. I guess we're fine. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 3459? Being none, close the public hearing on House Bill 3459 and open a work session on House Bill 3459. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill 3459 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3459 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Holden.
Mr. Chair, do we have to move the Dash 1 amendments in?
Oh, that's right. Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chairman.
Eagle Eye.
Representative Kitts.
Maybe Mr. Holvey didn't understand what I meant when I said I'd like to move the Dash 1 amendments in first.
It has nothing to do with that House floor, right?
I also want the Dash 1s on the House floor.
Representative Kitts moves the Dash 1s to House Bill 3459. Is there any objection? Seeing none, they're adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kitts.
As I feel I stated so eloquently before, I'd like to move House Bill 3459 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3459 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative Shockwell.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative
Westbrook.
Aye.
Representative
Gellman.
Aye.
Representative
Colby.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kitt.
In light of the very simplistic nature of this bill, and in order to save the global warming process that we're in right now and the hot air that would be expelled on the House floor, discussing such a bill, I'd place it on the consent calendar.
Representative Kitts moves the bill be placed on the consent calendar. Is any objection? Seeing none, it's done.
Did you repeat that?
No.
Okay, moving right along here.
Yep, calendar.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2389, and there's not a soul signed up to.
Let's move it out of here. Bad bill, shouldn't
Mark? And Don?
They drew me short straws in that lineup, didn't they?
We cleaned the audience out.
The last will be first.
Amen, brother.
We just gave these guys plenty of time to read the amendments, is what we did this morning. They just got the amendments this morning, so, but I.
Okay.
And that's
Janet.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to let the panel explain these, but they are. You have the Dash 1 amendments. They gotten stuff the original bill, so don't think about the original bill. And it relates to the transfer of the manufacturer structure program from DMV to Consumer and Business Services and to the counties.
Thank you, Janet. Okay, whoever wants to start.
I can start, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mark Long, Minister of Building Codes. To my right is Andre Simmons, manager of our policy shop in Building Codes, and helped out quite a bit in drafting this. This is, as staff indicated, a replacement for the language that was in 2389, and we thank Don and the Manufactured Housing Association for allowing us to use that vehicle to solve some technical fixes that we had with the bill that came last session, known as Senate Bill, last session, 2003, Senate Bill 460. This bill attempts to clarify some of our responsibilities in carrying out titling, registration of manufactured housing. And this is a new responsibility for the Building Codes Division that comes into effect on May 1, and we've found in the course of the last year, just a couple things we wanted to clean up. That's what this bill does. The second thing that this bill does, you may recall, thank you, Don. We were before the committee a week or so ago on House Bill 2579. It had Dash 1 amendments that was a complete replacement that fixed a problem with dealer licensing, a timing issue. It would have required dealers to relicense with us within 6 months, which made absolutely no sense. And we agreed to put that language in this bill as well. We've reviewed the bill this morning, and as far as I know, checking the staff and Don, we're comfortable and good to go and don't see any problems with it as drafted. So we would urge your support of Dash 1 amendments to 2389, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Well, I do have one, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I had these amendments in my office, and that's why it's taking so long. They were just sitting on my desk. My question to you is, do you anticipate anybody, nice people out there, finding anything wrong with this, going to come in here and jump up and down with their hair on fire? That's what I want to know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shoff, if I anticipated that, I wouldn't be here. But no, the answer is no. We've worked with the counties. They have a couple issues that we're fixing in here on their behalf, a couple issues for us, and, of course, the dealer issue for manufactured housing as well. And I think the other edits, I think you're comfortable
with.
They're
just fine.
Yeah. Okay. So,
thank you very much.
All right. Representative Kitts.
For clarification, have you ever seen anyone come up here running up and down jumping up and down with their hair on fire.
Chair Brown, Representative Kitskin, I do work in the construction industry, so I've seen quite a few different.
That's right on fire, I know that. Right.
Other than Michael Jackson during the filming of a Pepsi commercial.
Are there any plumbers in the audience?
Any other questions?
Be careful.
I don't see any. No more questions. All right, thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2389 and open a work session. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2389.
Representative Kitts moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2389. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they're adopted. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2389 as amended to the floor. Do pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2389 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll.
Representative
Kitts. Aye.
Representative
Bessel. Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Kitts.
Aye.
Representative
Chocolate. Aye. Chair Brown. Aye. Motion carries. Representative Kitts said he'd be willing to carry the bill.
I'm more than happy to, unless you want to place it on the consent calendar.
We might need to, just by the sheer thickness of it.
Yeah. What happened to our concerns about global warming?
Thank you, Representative.
Don't punch into Tata.
Janet is there.
Mr. Chair, no meeting Friday. No meeting Friday.
None Friday.
None Friday.
So you let us off. So you made it. You held us over last night
just
to make
in case
up for it.
Still got the same number of
in. Is this the 40-hour-a-week thing?
I'm dealing with the final paycheck. Okay.
Where the hell's my time card?
We're adjourned. Everybody left anyway.